We're talking with Wayne Pacelli of Animal Wellness Action. And if we haven't got your temper already fired up, we're going to touch on a couple of other issues in this hour that might get your attention. The pandemic, the cause of the pandemic, investigation now, whether it was animal related, whether it jumped from animals to humans, or whether there was a lab leak in the middle somewhere. And I know that is a point of contention right now, but there are some things that we can learn for how we treat animals and pandemics of the future. We're going to jump into that sticky wicket in just a moment here on Coast to Coast. Wayne, before we leave the issue of the wild Mustangs, you know, the Department of Interior has spent millions of dollars. Every 2 or 3 years, they'll commission a study. They get pressure from Congress and the public about the mistreatment of the Mustangs, and they'll get a study, and the study will tell them what they're doing wrong, which is pretty much everything. You know, rounding up horses sends the remaining herd into kind of reproductive overdrive, and it has exactly the opposite of the effect that they want sometimes. The money is spent on sending all masses of these horses to these big pens, often run by former BLM staffers back east. They get paid for the horses to be fed for the rest of their lives, taking them off of millions and millions of acres that were designated in the law for wild horses. You know, as you mentioned, there's 90,000 wild horses versus millions and millions of cattle and sheep, and it's the horses that are blamed for the problems. But you know, vast numbers of these acres, millions of acres, have been zeroed out of horses. There are none there. And they use it based on something called AML, this imaginary figure that they make up about how many horses should be allowed on any of the acreage to begin with. The pressure comes from cattle and sheep and the livestock industry to get rid of them, whereas they could be, undergo birth control, as you had mentioned, be let out on those millions of acres where there are no horses at all.
Yeah, George, you know, we're rounding up, the United States government is rounding up horses. Now, when you round them up and you're not directly killing them, you're holding them, you've got to feed them. I mean, the United States is basically operating a massive horse sanctuary. It's not a fabulous sanctuary for the horses, but they're feeding them every day. If you keep horses on the range, they will fend for themselves. They will consume the forage that the land produces. So two-thirds of the Bureau of Land Management's budget is being cannibalized by these holding facilities where they're rounding them up, and they've got 50,000 horses in holding. And the way they've been trying to address that is through this adoption incentive program, because, you know, for many years there's been a program to adopt wild horses. That would be a way where you can round them up, put them in the holding facility, but they won't be indefinitely at the holding facility because someone will adopt them. So they're giving people $1,000 to adopt a wild horse or burro. And a lot of these people are pocketing the money, and then they're selling the horse to slaughter, which is what the New York Times reported just a couple of weeks ago. This mismanagement is government at its worst. And again, the Wild Horse and Free Roaming Burro Act was passed in 1971 after a Nevadan campaigned for it. A woman who saw horses being poisoned and killed in the West, she said, we can do better than this. That law was a very important and good law, but it's being improperly implemented. And that's why continuing government oversight, continuing popular outrage is what's needed to turn this problem around.
Yeah, that law passed unanimously in Congress, by the way, unanimously. How long has it been since something like that happened?
Signed by Richard Nixon.
Let's change gears for a moment. The last time you were here, last March, it was the start of the pandemic. And the prevailing opinion at the time was that it looks like the COVID disease had jumped from animals due to these wet markets in China. Now we've learned that there's going to be an investigation to find out if there was a leak at the lab, which is the alternate theory that's been kicked around for a while. I tend to doubt that whatever the investigation digs up, that it will change anyone's mind, that people have sort of dug in their heels and are going to believe what they want to believe. But what can we learn about our treatment of animals, wet markets, our encroachment on animal habitats, that could be useful looking ahead to future pandemics?
Well, George, let's just remember that the history of disease has been a driver of the human experience. You know, for many of us, we haven't lived through big plagues. Of course, you know, 100 years ago, there was the Spanish flu, and that was a global pandemic, and it claimed 50 million lives at least. This COVID crisis, of course, has turned our world upside down. And as you indicated, live wildlife markets in Wuhan, China, have been implicated by the vast majority of people who have looked at this question. They've done sequencing of DNA, and they have matched it to bats, and bats then were thought to have infected some intermediate host, perhaps a civet cat or a pangolin or perhaps a mink, and that disease was passed from non-human animal to human. Now, whether this particular virus had its origin in a live wildlife market in Wuhan or in the Wuhan laboratory and was a product of science and human activity, there's no escaping the fact that two-thirds of all diseases that afflict human beings started in non-human animals, and they jumped the species barrier. So whether this was a tailor-made case of a virus jumping the species barrier or not, this has been part of our human experience, and it's part of the biology of the similarity of non-human animals to humans. You know, look at AIDS. AIDS almost certainly started as a consequence of humans eating primates in Africa. The SARS-CoV-1 virus in 2002-2003 certainly had its start in live wildlife markets in China. That was not a pandemic. It was an epidemic, but it really threatened people. There are all sorts of other issues, avian influenza, swine-based viruses. So now one thing I want to talk to you, George, about and to your listeners are mink farms. We are raising mink, a member of the mustelid family. These mink are small mammals, lean, narrow, long, with small animals, just weigh a few pounds. They're possessed with these beautiful coats, and that's why we kill them for their fur. So mink are trapped in the wild, and there are millions of mink on the North American continent. The species is called the American mink. But then we also raise them on fur farms. We raise them on factories like we raise chickens for eggs or for meat, or pigs for meat as well. And there are 60 million mink raised on factory farms throughout the world. Denmark had 17 million, the number one fur producer in the world. The mink happen to be the most susceptible mammal to COVID other than human beings. They're what's known as a bilateral transmitter. They can get the virus from people, and they can spill it back over to people. Denmark was so concerned after a variant developed, so a mutation of the coronavirus developed on a mink farm because tens and tens of thousands of them were infected, which meant many hosts and the possibility of mutation increased dramatically. They had something called a cluster 5 variant. We've heard of the UK variant, the South African variant, the Brazilian variant. We're very concerned about these different coronavirus variants. Well, one developed at a mink farm. Denmark killed all 17 million mink in a desperate effort to contain the virus. More than 4,000 people were infected by this mink variant. And remarkably, Denmark appears to have contained the global spread of this variant. But mink farms are the most dangerous incubators of a new potential variant in the world. And we're killing these animals. We're raising them on factory farms just for a luxury product, largely to go to the Chinese, because Americans are not consuming mink anymore, nor are Europeans. A thin strata of Chinese society, very wealthy Chinese, are buying these fur coats, and that's driving the production in about 25 countries in the world, including the United States. These mink farms are in our backyard. These mink are susceptible to the coronavirus in a nation where tens of thousands of people are still getting the virus. The mink can get it and then spill it back to us in variant form, making our vaccines potentially less effective in dealing with the virus. So we'll be soon introducing legislation with allies in Congress to ban mink farming, which should be banned just based on inhumane treatment of animals. But then when you think of the potential zoonotic spillover that can occur because of the mink farms, it becomes an urgent public health issue as well.
You have a sense of what happened with the Chinese or Asian wet markets and American wet markets, I guess, as a result of this pandemic? Did it make a dent?
Well, China in 2002 and 2003, after the SARS-CoV-1 virus, pledged to shut them down, but it turns out they invested a couple of years later billions of dollars in this, and the industry grew to be a $76 billion industry, raising all sorts of animals, wild animals, for human consumption, and also capturing them in the wild and then confining them and offering them up for sale. It appears that much of it has been curtailed in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. We don't know precisely how much, and you can't turn around something that big this fast, you know, to 100% effectiveness, but it's been substantially curtailed at this time. And in the United States, there's a bill in Congress called the Preventing Future Pandemics Act. Great bipartisan support. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, a conservative Republican, and Cory Booker, a liberal Democrat, had that bill. And then there's a House bill that has a similarly diverse set of leaders. So that bill seeks to stop the U.S.'s role in having live wildlife markets, because we do have those live wildlife markets in New York and San Francisco and L.A. and other parts of the U.S. It also sets up a diplomatic strategy for the United States to work with nations that are still essentially farming wildlife or collecting wildlife from their native habitats and confining them and selling them off. So it's very important. But between those live wildlife markets that we should be curtailing and the mink farms, this is a solid strategy to prevent the next pandemic from being launched. And if we don't understand the lessons, we're doomed to repeat this history. Shame on us.
I want to jump to one other issue. This is one that you mentioned to me that I have not investigated on my own before. It's about bison and hunting them in national parks. I guess the precedent would be a bad one if we go ahead and allow hunters into national parks. But can you tell us about that one?
Well, you know, national parks are perhaps one of the most popular features of American society. You know, it was in 1872 that President Grant signed legislation to create Yellowstone National Park. It draws millions of visitors every year, and we have created other parks, from Everglades National Park in Florida to Yosemite and many in between, and 350 million visits occur, more visits to America's national parks every year than there are people in the United States. So people are going multiple times, and people from all over the world are coming to our national parks. These are, you know, incredible places. They're a tonic for us to go visit. They preserve wildlife. They give us a respite from the construction of cities and towns that we have been capable of building. But there's still something magical about being in wildness and in wilderness. And really, it is a tonic to all of us who can experience nature. One feature of national parks since their formation is that their hunting is forbidden, because, you know, you only have millions of people. You don't want to be dodging bullets, and also hunting has certain behavioral effects on the animals. You know, if you're hunting elk populations or bison populations or wolves, they're going to run from you and you can't see them. And one of the great experiences that we have is by watching these animals. That's part of the experience of going to the park and seeing them. Well, Grand Canyon National Park, which was created in 1919, one of the jewels of our national park system, has bison, which the National Park Service deemed as a native species in a report that it did in 2016. So these are native species. There are only 300 of them in the northern rim of the park. If you drive down from Las Vegas and head toward Grand Canyon, you enter the north rim, and you'll see these bison grazing, you know, in these beautiful fields. And the National Park Service essentially said, we're going to allow hunting because some local politicians wanted to have a hunt. The Park Service just a couple of weeks ago had a lottery for 12 permits to shoot these bison. Now, these bison are used to millions of people clicking their cameras at them. You can walk up to them. You know, it wouldn't be a smart thing because they're very powerful. But behaviorally, they're accustomed to a non-threatening human presence, so they don't run. So they auctioned off 12 permits to hunt them. 45,000 people applied for this lottery to shoot bison in one of our national parks, perhaps one of the three or four most famous parks in the United States, in the world. This, George, subverts the U.S. policy of forbidding hunting. Are we going to allow hunting in Yellowstone or Yosemite or Everglades next? I think it's a terrible precedent. the Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who was confirmed, you know, a few weeks back, should not be party to this. The United States should not subvert this 100-year policy of protecting animals in national parks. If there's management that needs to be done, it can be done by other means rather than having a lottery system and having trophy hunters invade our national parks.
On the subject of trophy hunters, the last time you were here, we had, every time you're here, we talk about trophy hunting, Safari International, where they put up these packages, they bid $80,000 to $100,000 for somebody's right to go shoot endangered or imperiled species, exotic species, and then so they can bring the heads back. Not so they can eat them, but just so they can bring the heads back and put it on a wall and impress their friends, their fellow dentists or something like that. Where do things stand now? There was some flux in the last administration about whether or not the heads would be allowed to be imported back into the U.S. I just lost track of where it stands.
Yeah. George, trophy hunting is a big thing in the United States. It's a small percentage of people who do it, but they have a lot of political power, so it persists. And globally, it's a big thing. And as you said, the Safari Club International, which is an Arizona-based group, gives out hunting awards and hunting achievements to people who meet certain kill quotas. One simple one is called the Africa Big Five, and you get an award if you shoot an elephant, a rhino, a lion, a leopard, and a Cape buffalo. But there are 29 different hunting achievement awards. You can shoot antlered game of the world, big cats of the world, bears of the world, where you shoot 5 of the 8 bear species. This is fueling international trophy hunting, this awards and prizes program that the Safari Club essentially has created to drive this commercial enterprise. The real rub on this issue is the hunting of threatened and endangered species, because if they're not threatened or endangered, the Safari Club is basically, you know, free to do what it wants all over the world if these countries sell off their wildlife to these rich, elite Americans who want to shoot them in a head-hunting exercise. But this rubs up against the U.S. Endangered Species Act. So we list species as threatened or endangered who live in the U.S., but we also have a foreign-listed species. So we list the African elephant as threatened or endangered, and the African lion as threatened or endangered, the leopard, the cheetah, and a number of other species. Now, we can't control what Zimbabwe or Namibia or Chad or the Democratic Republic of Congo do, but we can limit imports of their parts. And that's what the Endangered Species Act does. That's the sort of protection that it provides for these foreign listed species. So the United States does not allow hunting of threatened or endangered species here. So the grizzly bears in Montana cannot be legally hunted. The Florida panther cannot be legally hunted. But somehow we've been allowing African elephants to be hunted by rich Americans, and they can bring the heads and the tusks back into the United States. Now, we tell poor Africans, don't kill these elephants, because, you know, we're against the ivory trade, which is the right position for us to take, but it's okay for rich Americans to go shoot the elephants and then bring the ivory back. I think that's a terrible inconsistency in our policy. So elephants, for the most part, have stopped coming in, although it's difficult to get this information from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We've restricted most of the lions coming in, but 700 lion heads and parts were coming into the United States, 600 of them from canned hunting facilities in South Africa. South Africa has 350 lion farms where they raise lions in a fenced enclosure for people to have cub petting when the lions are juveniles, and they can take walks with the juvenile animals. But then when they get older, Americans and Germans can go and shoot them and historically bring their heads back into the United States. That stopped after we succeeded in getting lions listed as threatened and endangered across their range in Africa in 2016. But there's still some wild lions coming in, even though there are only 20,000 wild lions throughout all of Africa, which is an enormous continent.
Wayne Pacelli, we'll pick up the part about trophy hunting, then open up the phone lines. I'm sure there are a lot of people that want to yell at you about this or that, and we'll do that on the other side. And we're talking with Wayne Pacelli of Animal Wellness Action and getting into trophy hunting. And of course, would a, say, an American dentist pay $80,000, plop down $80,000 for the right to go shoot an elephant or shoot a lion if they couldn't bring the heads back? What do you think? We're going to get into that with Wayne in just a moment here and then open up the phone line, see what's on your mind. We'll be right back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Wayne, so would an American hunter, this brave hunter who goes over to Africa to shoot a lion that's raised in a lion farm in a canned hunt, would he plop down 80 grand or so to if he couldn't bring back the head? And what is our current status in that law? Do we allow it or not?
Almost certainly not. He would not bring home, or he would not shoot the animal if he couldn't bring the trophy home. That's the purpose of this exercise. The picture is only so much. The experience is only so much. They want to brag about it. Now you cannot bring a lion shot at a captive hunting facility from South Africa. That's where six of seven lion heads were coming over the last, 20 years. But still, that sixth of seventh, or that seventh of seventh, may be coming in. It's a little unclear. And really, we need to know what the new administration is thinking about imports of threatened or endangered species trophies. Our policy at Animal Wellness Action and Animal Wellness Foundation is clear. No way. You shouldn't be allowed to kill a threatened or endangered species overseas and bring the parts back into the United States. No way.
And shoot an elephant. I mean, because I've done so many stories about circus elephants, I got to know one. I got to see this one Jenny that was rescued from circus operations in horrible conditions. And it's just so awesome being around one. I could not possibly imagine shooting an elephant.
Well, they're the biggest land animals in the world. They're incredibly intelligent. The families live together, the grandparents, the parents, the juveniles together. You shoot one and they lose a member of their community. They grieve for the ones who die, whether at human hands or from other causes. I mean, these are animals who are all there when it comes to their consciousness and awareness. And I think, George, this is what underlies our whole discussion, that animals are not just things. They're not commodities. They're not automatons. They're living, breathing, thoughtful creatures. They have lives that matter to them just as much as our lives matter to us. And if we can avoid causing them pain and suffering, given the terrible history of human actions toward animals, then we should exercise that moral choice and be good to these other creatures.
Take a couple of calls. We'll go to the wild card line. Brendan in Austin. Hi, Brendan. Hello.
Hello, guys. Thank you so much. It's amazing to always get on with you. I'll make it super quick for everybody so we can get some more people. Also, for anybody that isn't following Mystery Wire, follow that. It's amazing. It's with George Knapp. Okay, so my question was about superbugs. I wanted him to talk about how we give a lot of antibiotics to all of the animals that are in the factory farms and how that's going to affect the bacteria in the future. And also, super quickly, on a paranormal side on this topic, I haven't eaten meat in like 10 years, and I definitely think the spirits and ghosts can tell when you're not eating meat, especially because the meat that y'all are talking about is really low in vibrational energy. The animals are suffering a long time. So when you eat that, I feel like that has something to do with your soul and your energy, and the spirits around you can interact with you differently because of that. So, yep, that's my topic. Thank you.
On the superbug part, Wayne.
Yes. Well, Brendan, thank you for that. Essentially what we're doing is 80 to 90% of all antibiotics consumed in our nation are fed to animals on factory farms. We overcrowd them so significantly that we anticipate that these places are incubators of disease. So we try to essentially inoculate them, if you will, prevent the onset of disease by giving them antibiotics, which is exactly the opposite thing we tell people to take antibiotics. We're not supposed to use them as a prophylactic. You're supposed to use them after you're sick for a discrete period of time, but we're overusing them. We're creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria on these factory farms, which can render, these bacteria broadly resistant to our antibiotics, and those have been life-saving solutions for us when it comes to public health.
Thanks for the call. We're going to the first-time caller line, Janet in Washington. Hi, Janet.
Hey, George. Hi there, Wayne Pacelli. I have a question. I agree with you about wet markets in China and this whole COVID thing, but one thing that also concerns me are the increased number of biocontainment labs that are opening that tests on animals. And there's one scheduled to open in 2023. It hasn't been completely cleared yet, in Manhattan, Kansas. And they're going to be studying level 4 pathogens such as Nipah virus. And the hosts are tropical fruit bats. And it can cause severe respiratory and neurological animal disease in swine, but mortality in humans can also range from 40 to 75%. No drug therapies or countermeasures exist. And also they're thinking of starting to do foot and mouth disease research there in the mainland, which has been outlawed in the past and because of not been considered safe. And there's been some conflict between scientists and politicians, whether they've demonstrated through their risk summaries yet that it is safe enough. But the thing is, besides spreading to cattle and sheep and goats, it would also pose a problem for wild animals such as deer, elk, bison, mountain goats or whatever. It's a very infectious disease. And my thought is, I think these type of labs need stronger oversight, and we really have to question whether, and like, none of these diseases are on the American mainland yet. And my feeling is, if they're going to do it, they need to get on an island. Previously, they were on Plum Island, but the citizens of Manhattan and Connecticut got together and said, no, you're not going to study level 4 pathogens. So then they've been going to different areas trying to find a substitute. And so I'm really concerned about the risk this poses, especially after COVID. The last risk summary was done in 2012. So I feel they need to do another one, and the American public needs to have the opportunity to weigh in on this after everything we've gone through with COVID.
Well, thanks, Janet. Let's see. Wayne, are you up on this one?
Well, Janet, thank you. Very astute observations and important observations. I think, we have to have more disclosure and we have to have more discussion about these sorts of things. I think my general notion on this is, when we stop the mistreatment of animals and we stop, eating primates, when we stop having live wildlife markets, when we stop keeping wild mink on factory farm conditions, we really take good preventative action and don't set ourselves up for the emergence of a new pathogen. Obviously, research and science into this area is important, but we've got to do it prudently. And I think your comments are wise about having more disclosure so we can have an honest debate about this. A lot of this stuff happens in secrecy. In 2015, there was a farm animal government lab called the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, and the New York Times exposed terrible abuses of the animals to basically, make factory farms even more efficient. So our government doesn't have a great history when it comes to management of animals in some of these laboratories.
Thanks for the call, Janet. We're going to go to Rob in Pennsylvania on the wild card line. Hi, Rob.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What's on your mind? Ask Wayne if he ever heard of Dr. McCleary in Kane, Pennsylvania. He rescued the Lobo wolves back in the 1900s.
I've not heard of him. I'll be happy to look him up. What do you know about him?
There's a book out called The Wolfman, and basically he got wolf puppies from out in Wyoming, I think, and brought them back to Kane, Pennsylvania, and raised them and rescued them. And they're still alive today.
Well, I'm certainly concerned about wolves, and I'm concerned about their treatment in the wild. And wherever they're holding on, they're being persecuted, whether it's in the northern Great Lakes, where in Wisconsin at the end of February, 200 wolves, more than 200 wolves out of perhaps a population of only 800 to 1,000, were killed in a 48-hour period, where the state of Wisconsin allowed the use of dogs to hunt wolves, setting up an animal fighting situation. Idaho's governor just passed just signed a law to essentially reduce Idaho's wolf population by 90% 90%. So we are not doing well with wolves. And this gentleman you mentioned from 100 years ago or so who showed compassion for wolves, we need to invoke his spirit more and not this persecution of wolves, which is continuing in our modern-day circumstance.
Thanks, Rob. We're going west of the Rockies. Jesus in California. Hello.
Hi, George, and hi, Wayne. Thank you for being there. I'm a dog lover. I have two dogs that I consider my boys. I call them my boys. They love me probably more than I am able to put out love. The thing is that there seems to be some kind of disconnect that's going on with people this country, just like they would eat my boys over in another country, with people and animals because of their being, you know, all animals. I'm not talking, you know, just about my boys and domestic dogs. I'm talking about the chickens and the cows and the wild animals. There seems to be some kind of disconnect, and all they have to do is look at YouTube, like unbelievable, and see the animals, the wild animals, even looking out for each other and looking out for people. Well, my comment is that with the disconnect, even serial killers have been noted to not have any conscience of caring about that. Well, with all those killings and shootings and everything going on nowadays, I believe there's even more than when these factory farms and everything with the disconnect of how animals are treated with people and their conscience for love and for another being, you know. And so my question is how do we make that, you know, I mean, not make other people get the connection of that, because not everybody's a dog lover like me and have my, like my boys or my kids. I mean, how do we spread this other than what you're doing right now and the millions of people that are listening? Because like I told you, I mean, these are my boys. These, just like I birthed them, I mean, they love me more than I probably love them. And the thing is,
all right, Jesus, let's let Wayne weigh in. We appreciate the call and the sentiment that you have for your boys. I guess it boils down to thinking about the choices that we make. I mean, small changes in having a conscience in our purchasing power, what we buy, what we do, can have huge effects.
You're correct, George. And Jesus, of course, makes the argument on why we should be concerned that animals have lives that are important to them, that they have characteristics that are shared characteristics with people. You know, they have emotions, they have feelings, they experience terror and fear. They can also experience happiness and joy. Once we begin to understand that animals have these capacities, it seems to me that we're in denial in some ways, that we're disconnected from these practices that we're participating in through the marketplace, or not holding government accountable to do these terrible things to animals, like round up our wild horses, or, you know, give subsidies to factory farms to perpetuate these inhumane practices. So it's not just the animals whom we know in our lives. We have to have a broader ethic to understand that all of these mammals, all of these birds matter, and that we should organize our thinking in a logical way to protect them more meaningfully.
We already make moral judgments every day. You know, we wouldn't eat our dog, but we'd eat a pig that is smart and social and sociable and you know, things like that. That's a conscious choice that's made.
Well, and George, you know, we have 180 years in this country of living under anti-cruelty statutes. I mean, a long time ago, prior generations decided that cruelty to animals was wrong. I think our goal and our task really before us today is to logically apply anti-cruelty principles to a wide range of domesticated animals and wild animals, and to hold ourselves, you know, to a standard of behaving in a way that would honor these creatures, whether they're in our home or they're, you know, halfway around the world, whether they're kangaroos in Australia killed for making shoes, or they're orangutans trying to hold on in Indonesia, or, you know, pigs or chickens on a factory farm whose plight we don't think about, but we're connected to through our purchasing practices every single day.
Animal Wellness Action, how's it doing?
We're doing great. We're adding more and more people. We have an amazing new scientist who's joined our team. People can find out about the wide range of campaigns at animalwellnessaction.org, our sister organization, Center for a Humane Economy. That centerforhumaneeconomy.org is working to push corporations to incorporate animal welfare into their thinking and their R&D programs and operations and supply chains. We've got a big task, but we're looking at the macro level use of animals and trying to turn around some of these longstanding problems.
Wayne Pacelli, you're always welcome here. Please keep us in the loop about animal welfare issues moving forward.
George, thanks for everything. You're one of the best.
We'll talk to you again.